Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, women's voices on culture, style, society and well-being. Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to be here.
And we're sitting in my living room. You came to me. I'm so pleased. And you are on your way to your fabulous book launch.
Hooray.
Hooray, which is going to be in Notting Hill on Kensington Park Road at Luton's and Rubenstein. Fabulous bookshop because it's owned by two women. Love that. Can't say enough about local bookshops.
Yeah, I know.
Please. Go. Whereas you live in Cambridge.
No, I live in Reading.
Oh, you live in Reading.
Yeah, I lived in Cambridge. I studied at Cambridge, but I
studied
in Reading.
At Cambridge. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Why Reading?
Because I studied there. I went there to do a postgraduate research degree in fairies in Victorian children's literature.
Amazing.
And ended up meeting a man and staying.
Wow. Tell me about fairies. What brought you? To that specific area of study?
Fairies. Well, I wanted to do a research degree in children's literature because that's what I was interested in. And Victorian children's literature. I was a big Lewis Carroll fan, mostly because of Alice in Wonderland. But I'm also a huge Sherlock Holmes fan. I'm a total Sherlock Holmes geek.
Same here.
Brilliant. Yes.
Read the whole thing. I remember I had Poison Ivy and my eyes were practically swollen shut, but I had the total collection and I had to stay home from school. Itchy, covered with poison ivy, sweeping sores, and reading everything. And I was like, what's a carbuncle?
That's sort of different meanings.
Carbuncle. Yeah. Blue carbuncle. I remember that one. But,
So I'm a huge Sherlock Holmes geek. So you probably know Arthur Conan Doyle's connection with these fake fairy photographs.
Yes.
And Cottingley fairies. And I was really interested in those and how what they said about late 19th and early 20th century views of children, especially girls. And so I decided to look at a range of literature with fairies in them, connected with fairies, to see how they portrayed what children were seen to be like. So I looked at those photographs as a real life thing, and I got to go and look at the actual photographs up in Leeds, which was very cool. And I also looked at Lewis Carroll's really awful book called Sylvie and Bruno, which is terrible. Don't ever read it. It's awful. And
what makes it so awful?
Oh, well, it's really boring. And it's mostly about how wonderful Sylvie and Bruno are and how sweet they are and how lovely fairies are and tra-la-la. I mean, the thing is about Alice in Wonderland is it's very satirical and funny, but he lost his sense of humor completely.
And harsh and, you know,
really
it has
violent.
Some real harsh and, yeah. Which is what draws us in and it's drama,
exactly.
You know. But if you just have, you know, nice, sweet fairy children, who cares?
Exactly.
Yeah. Unless they're stubbing their toes, we're not interested.
Yeah, so he was trying to be too much what children are supposed to be like rather than looking at what children really are and that. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. I did Rudyard Kipling, Puck of Pook's Hill, and then a couple of others. It was a really enjoyable way to spend 3 years on fairies.
Yes. And just for people who don't know, because Arthur Conan Doyle lost a lot of credibility. Mm-hmm. Because he got very involved in the spiritualist movement and, you know, and seances and things like this and took it very, very seriously. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and he, you know, sort of credited these photos of fairies, which, you know, were pretty, weren't they pretty soon realized to be fake?
They're really obviously faked. And the thing is, when you look at it, I mean, they're cutouts. The girls had traced fairies from a book, a very widely published book at the time. They traced them and then cut them out and stuck them on plants with pins and then taken their pictures next to them. And Arthur Conan Doyle was pretty sure that these girls were very young and very innocent and would never do such a thing. But he didn't really mention that one of the girls was 16 and actually working in a photographic studio at the time. So that's not mentioned in any of that. You have to sort of dig to find that sort of stuff out.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, so, and then, because we were just talking, you're from Maine, I'm from New York, washed up on these shores into fairyland, Of Reading.
Reading, yes, Fairyland.
Otherwise known as Fairyland. Not so much. But then you started writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, then I started teaching secondary school.
Wow.
And then after a while, then I started writing.
Yeah. And why did you start writing? Was it something that always pulled you? Obviously, you've always been interested in literature, but what pulled you in?
I always wanted to be a writer. Yeah. Right from the age, very, very young age, I was always writing, you know, making little books out of paper mm-hmm. and writing them. And I wrote my first novel when I was 11 because I just read A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula Le Guin. And I loved it so much that I sat down and wrote my own version with a girl as a wizard instead of a boy and awesome. Drew the pictures, you know, and everything. I still have it. It's about 100 pages long.
Wow.
I was obsessed with writing. And then in high school, my best friend and I used to write stories about us basically having sex with the Beatles. or this is dating me, New Kids on the Block.
Oh.
Which is what pulled me into writing romance and romantic novels, really.
I could pretend. better subjects, thank goodness, because we get to what number novel is Where Love Lies?
I think it's number 14.
Wow.
I think it's number 14. It might be number 15.
So was it like teaching that you were like, I can't do this anymore, I can't tell everyone else how to do it, but I need to
I
do
loved
it myself.
Teaching. Yeah. I really liked it, but it just, after 5 years of teaching, I really wanted something else in my life, so mm-hmm. I started writing in the evenings and the weekends, and I decided that I would try to write for Mills and Boone because I thought it would be super easy to do.
Mm-mm.
And it really isn't.
No.
So I had to write a lot of books, but eventually I did get some books accepted by Mills and Boone. So I wrote for them for several years, and that was what allowed me to give up teaching and mm-hmm. write full time and start writing bigger books
mm-hmm.
With more complicated subjects. So I've written a lot of books, but they've gotten sort of more and more complex with every novel, sort of moving from Mills and Boone to something a little bit more twisted, like Where Love Lies.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice.
And also having the confidence, because it is a very romantic book, and it's a very romantic notion at its heart, and it is essentially about love, but it is a more intellectual book than that.
It's pretty far from Mills and Boone, I think.
Yes.
It begins where a lot of romance ends. Mm-hmm. So it begins with the hero and heroine married, and they've been married for a year, and they had their whirlwind romance. But then the heroine is starting to get second thoughts about, oh gosh.
Post-honeymoon.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, because they're just coming up to their first year reunion, and he's still in the honeymoon period. He still thinks that everything about her is absolutely wonderful.
Mm.
But like, she's not got that.
Yeah. It's like, wow, he really does do the same things over and over. He's very predictable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so okay, I'm going to allow you to tell as much of the story, because I don't want to ruin it for anyone, but I want it. I figure you're probably the best judge of that. So I'm going to allow you to tell as much of the story of Where Love Lies as you can.
It's tricky because it does have a twist to it.
Mm-hmm.
But so we have Felicity and Quinn, who've been married for a year. And they live in a small village in a beautiful cottage that's falling down around their ears with roses around the door. And his family live just across the common from them, and they pop in all the time to see each other. And Felicity, who's a sort of free spirit, finds it all quite suffocating. And it's a very small world for her.
It's a bit claustrophobic.
Yeah.
His sister lives in the village. His parents live in the village. I mean, she knows what she's doing every Sunday for the rest of her life.
That's right.
Having lunch with these people.
Yeah.
She just so happens to buy, you know, something unusual in the store. Everybody in the village knows about it.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I didn't know you were having, you know, paella for tea, you know, or something, you
they
know,
all
like,
know
like
everything.
That. Yeah, it's a tiny, but loving.
Yeah, it's very loving. And in some ways, it's an idyllic place to be. But it's for her, she grew up as a really free spirit. Her mother is was quite a well-known artist. She's dead. And they used to travel from place to place. Sometimes they had money, sometimes they didn't. They would go to different countries. She's lived abroad. She lived in New York and in Paris. And
totally bohemian.
She is, and existence. She, you know, she only bought a watch after she got married, so she wouldn't be late to meet her husband. And you know, so it's a beautiful place to live, and her husband loves her absolutely, just absolutely. And people who've read the book keep on writing to me to say, "Oh my God, he's so lovely," because he loves her so much. But she has doubts about what's happening,
and because she has doubts, she, which I very much understand, she can see, she feels that this, the intensity and enormity of her husband's love is a bit of a burden.
Yeah.
Because, and it sort of shows her up, and it shows her, it makes her have to take her doubts very seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he loves her so much. Mm-hmm. It's almost a responsibility.
Yeah.
To have somebody love you that much. And she feels she has to live up to it. And she doesn't feel worthy of him.
Yeah.
And as the book goes on, you learn why she doesn't feel worthy of him. But,
and I think we can say, because I think everyone has experienced that. But I think you're quite lucky to experience it. If you have been in a relationship long enough. I remember the day I got married, I just found my mother's writing, like in her writing, what she had written, was that, you know, she said, it's great now, but if you're lucky enough, you'll find something deeper later. Mm-hmm. And there's also a deeper love, but you can't manufacture newness,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you can't manufacture like what you felt like when you first met,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get other stuff, but you can't. And she starts to sort of relive an earlier love,
mm-hmm.
you know, in her memory. It starts, you know, resurfacing for her in a very compelling way.
Yeah.
And I think everyone has done that at a certain point when they're questioning, something else becomes, you know, looms larger.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, in the memory.
She's in that place right now where she is questioning her marriage. Not that she wants to get out of it necessarily, because she does love Quinn, but just questioning, is this the right thing for mm-hmm. me? Is this what I want for the rest of my life?
Mm-hmm.
He wants to start a family. She's not sure. And then she suddenly, like you said, starts being revisited. First it's with a scent,
mm-hmm.
and I'm wearing it right now. Actually, I'm wearing it's a scent of frangipani, which I have on.
Very lovely and delicate.
It's really exotic, but it comes out of nowhere for her, and the scent really reminds her of this man who she had, her first love, who mm-hmm. she knew before she met her husband, 10 years before, and they had a very, very, very intense relationship. That sort of relationship where you just can't get enough of each other.
Well, and also, I mean, yeah, it's easy then. You know, you don't have to think about mortgages and whatever, you know, and like, you know what I mean?
She's
sure.
20.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Of course it's hot.
Yeah, he's a rock star.
Yeah,
Exactly. They have none of this day-to-day mortgage. Who's going to make the tea? Who's mm-hmm. going to do the shopping? Mm-hmm. What do we do about the neighbor's cat? Why does the neighbor keep on stealing our bicycle? None of that. Uh-huh. All they have to do is, 10 years ago, all they had to do was be in love and float around and drink beer. She says at one point, I don't think I ever ate in the same room with him. Had lots of sex.
Yeah.
And that was what their relationship was uh-huh. like. And so she starts getting this scent and these very, very strong memories of being so intensely in love with this man.
Mm.
And because she's questioning her life anyway, she thinks that it's some sort of sign.
Yeah, that she's not in her marriage fully.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, enough on that, because we're not going to get, we don't want to reveal anymore.
No.
And it is a really good read. And oddly, because there's a real element of suspense, and very oddly for a romantic book, it really is a page turner, and you are on the seat of your pants and like, oh, is she going to tear everything down around her? Or is she, you know? So I highly recommend
read.
Have fun at the opening tonight. I don't want to talk about where this idea came from, but for your other novels, like, you know, because you're a prolific writer now.
Mm-hmm.
Once you started, you're just like, okay, I'm, you know, tell me about like where your ideas come from. Sort of what sparks a story?
It's all sorts of different things. Mm. And the thing is that I know a lot of writers who will be writing one story and then they'll suddenly get an idea for another story mm-hmm. and find it very difficult. But I'm not. I'm quite monogamous. So when I'm writing a story...
And the writing's her lover. Dear husband.
Well, actually, my husband might say that, yeah.
It's very compelling, isn't it?
Yeah. It's, when I'm in a story, I'm in the story, and that's the story that I want to be in, and I don't think of any other ideas. But once I've finished it, then I sort of start casting around, and you can't do anything. You just have to live for a while. So I go to see films, I read books, and I go for walks, and I just cook and try to do things that don't involve me creating anything, but just taking things in. Mm-hmm. And then eventually just an idea will come. And usually sometimes it's from something I read, or sometimes in the case of Where Love Lies, it was something that happened to a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. With Dear Thing, which is my book before, it was a situation that I had gone through myself, because that's a book about infertility. Mm-hmm. And so I had lost, I had some miscarriages, and so I used that in the novel.
Was that hard to use, or did it help heal to use?
It really helped to heal, actually. Mm-hmm. I think articulating your experience is very, very useful. Even if it's not your experience exactly, because mm-hmm. it's the character's experience, it helps you understand it from different angles, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really well informed. Sadly, but yeah. When you said you read things, what kind of books are you reading?
I read everything, like mm-hmm. seriously everything. So right now I'm reading Anna Karenina, mm-hmm. Mainly because a character in the book that I'm writing is a... lecturer in Russian literature, and she has based her entire life around Anna Karenina. She told me this before I read Anna Karenina, so I'm like, okay, the character told me I have to read it, so I'm reading it now. And it's
poor
good.
You.
No, I'm enjoying it.
Oh, she just drives me crazy, though. But then you have to think about it in historical context.
Yes.
What else was she going to do all day long, other than obsess?
Exactly. She had nothing else.
She had nothing else to do.
Really, really... intelligent exploration of the lack of power that women have.
I think you're right. And seen in that, it's, you know, because it's very pre-feminist, mm-hmm. but it really does show just how, I mean, without the armature of marriage, mm-hmm. she was nothing.
No, no. Yeah. And all she had to captivate this man on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I haven't finished it yet, so don't tell me how it ends. I'm expecting it doesn't end now.
It involves a little red bag. I don't want to...
Don't tell me too much. But yeah. But I mean, he was writing at the same time as people like George Eliot.
Yes.
Who also, with Middlemarch, that was also about the powerlessness of women. But what's interesting about this is how frank it is, because it shows childbirth. Mm-hmm. Now, I've done 2 degrees in Victorian literature, and I'd never seen childbirth.
I just thought they hatched by pods.
They just sort of turn up suddenly.
Yeah,
somebody gets married.
Home, you know.
they show it, and they, you know, and it talks about at one point one of the Oblonsky's wife talks about her sore nipples when she had children, and I'm shocked by how open that is. I mean, it's mm-hmm. not open now, but,
but still,
frank it is for that time.
Yeah. And it took, of course, a man could say it. You know?
Well, yes, exactly.
Heaven forfend. Yeah, because that was, you know, in Victorian times, wasn't that your lying in period? You know, her indoors.
Exactly.
You wouldn't see
them.
Shocking.
They just disappear from the novel and then sort of come back later on with a child or having sent the child to the nanny.
Yes, exactly. They see it on Wednesdays and Fridays. That's it.
Yeah.
But we look forward to seeing what is next from the fabulous Julie Cohen.
Thank you so much.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?